Hey everybody, Rob here, getting you set for this week's edition, the week three edition of the Why Blank Lost podcast with David Bloomberg that I was unable to record with David over the weekend when we normally record this podcast. And then David could only record the podcast on Monday night, and I had already committed to a belated trip to Disney with my wife and the kids on Monday of this week. So our schedules just did not work out, but our great friend Mike Bloom was able to fill in for me on the podcast tonight. So you're going to be treated to the Bloom on Bloomberg edition of Why Blank Lost this week. So thanks again to Mike Bloom. Greatly appreciate that, allowing me to get out of the podcast studio for a day. Greatly appreciated. So thanks again, Mike. I'll be back with you with BBOT and Australian Survivor coverage, not to mention News AF, all on Tuesday. So I will talk to you again soon. Enjoy the podcast.
Coming to you live from the Podcast Summit, it's Rob Has a Podcast. But hold the podcast, skip the Rob on this one, because Rob is not here. Hi, everyone. I'm Mike Bloom, filling in for Rob as he takes his family to, let's assume to be a magical time at Disneyland. I heard he was actually having some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches down with some millennial Disney stars in downtown Disney. So we wish him all the best of luck in the world. But I'm here to cover for him on this week's edition of Why Blank Lost. I am the variable in this equation, but let's bring on the man who is the constant here, who wrote the whole manifesto about why these players have lost. David Bloomberg, how you doing?
Mike, I just don't want to talk to you right now. Can you give me some space?
I just want to let you know, just a few things.
Can you just give me some space right now? That's all I'm asking. Can you respect that I don't want to talk to you right now?
If only we had a third person to like pipe up randomly and say, yeah, leave him alone, Mike. Then we could really have this edition of RHAP Masterpiece Knockoff Theater come to full fruition. David, how's it going?
Good. I can't believe Rob was so overcome with depression and jealousy about the Mets that he couldn't come to the podcast to talk to a Cubs fan.
I don't think anyone realized that I put Disney in loose quotations. Obviously, we wish Rob the best of luck in his recovery as he continues to bring himself out of the doldrums from the subsequent Mets loss, which as a sports fan, I'll admit, I didn't really know much about until about 5 minutes ago. So thank you for informing me of that, David.
Sure.
I knew the Blue Jays won, but that's about it.
Yeah. And as of when we record this podcast, I'm still waiting to see what happens with the Cubs. But hopefully by the time people are listening to this, the Cubs will have swept the Giants. So
absolutely.
We'll have to see. But, you know, Rob and I at least are in the same boat when it comes to football. I have the Bears who suck and he has the Jets who suck. But to my surprise, the Bears actually won last week, although just barely.
Was that a pun? Just barely?
It wasn't meant to be, but we'll go with it. I didn't know there was a worse team in the NFL. However, they went back to form this week by blowing it. And I don't know if you know this, but I had a running bet with Darnell about whether the Bears would get more wins than Lucy would get confessionals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Lucy didn't get any confessionals on TV, but she did get one on the web. So I don't know if that counts as part of our bet.
Yeah, I guess is that some sort of partial credit? I guess in the world of Big Brother, it might be considered credit nowadays.
Right. Well, right nowadays, everything's on the web on Big Brother. So,
well, speaking of predictions, do you want to talk a little bit about what you and Rob discussed, prognosticated from last week and how it might reflect this week?
Yeah. You know, without him here, I can fully gloat about my prediction.
Gloat away, my friend.
Yes. Now, we were all way off in predicting an unmerge to three tribes. But I don't care, because I predicted that Paul would be voted out, and who really cares about how it happened? The fact is that it happened, and I was right. So, like last week, I'm going to ignore the parts where I was wrong and celebrate the part that I got right.
Perfect. What did you think in general about the sort of bait and switch of, I think you two were not alone, and that most of us were believing they were doing the tribe mitosis and Corp 2.0 going down to three tribes, only for this aforementioned mixer to happen with seemingly no result, at least for now?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the fact that has been discussed before, that Survivor doesn't get to determine what the commercials are going to be. That's mm-hmm. CBS. And I guess CBS didn't want to say, and next time on Survivor, there will be peanut butter and jelly and a meeting. You know, so they came up with something that sounded much more flamboyant and important and it was neither.
Yes, none of the above. Anything else you want to say about this most recent episode before we dive into the rules themselves?
Well, you know, since this episode, there has been a lot of criticism leveled at Jessica and her allies for wanting to
make... Jessica just had a baby. We shouldn't be criticizing her.
Oh, different Jessica.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. That Jessica deserves only praise and has
gotten
only
praise. Especially for live tweeting Survivor while in labor, apparently.
I can't believe Jeff Probst did not give her a buff. I don't know if he ran out of buffs before, you know, it was announced to him that she was doing this, but he just ignored those tweets.
Well, I don't think what you realize, David, is that Jeff Probst was actually in the birthing room with her, giving all the great encouragement that we know Jeff Probst loves to give to women, especially.
So he was yelling at Jessica, "Dig, woman!"
Yes, and hopefully not treating her like he treated Cece on the balance beam. Jessica is losing this for her husband.
So anyway, the Jessica who's on the show, you know, it gets confusing, you know, because you've got Jessica and Jessica. I'm David. We've got a David on the show. On Big Brother, you've got Alex Kidwell and Alex the HOH. They have to come up with names that aren't part of Rob Has a Podcast.
I know. It's only polite of them to do so.
Yeah. A lot of people have been criticizing Jessica and her allies for wanting to make a big move too soon by blindsiding Paul. And we'll get into that later. But, you know, there's a question. Is that criticism warranted, or was there a good reason for what they did? Well, Paul left with final words saying, apparently, somebody played better than I did. I would say back to him that actually, Paul, a lot of people played better than you did. So let's figure out what he did right, where he went wrong, and why Paul lost.
Perfect. And I'm assuming that there will be much more ascribed meaning to it than just he told Jessica the wrong thing at the wrong time, which is why we have this podcast in the first place. So let's start with the first rule, David: scheme and plot. Over the course of three episodes, did Paul scheme and plot, in your opinion?
Well, for the first 2 weeks, we said goodbye to players who weren't doing much of any scheming and plotting. That wasn't the case this week, because Paul was not only in the thick of what appeared to be, and you know, was until that moment, the majority core alliance, but he was generally thought to be its leader by at least those on the outside. One part of this rule tells players to get into an alliance right away, and Paul did that. His group came together pretty quickly, which seemed like a good way for him to stay safe. But with that said, I have to wonder how much actual scheming and plotting he was doing, because from various things said by Paul himself and Chris and others, I feel like Paul was actually kind of drawn into the alliance by Chris and Brett. Mm. So, for example, he claimed in his interview with Josh that he never felt like he was the leader of the alliance, but those other guys used his big personality as a big target so he could basically be a meat shield for them. It makes me wonder, was it really Paul doing the scheming, or was it just the fact that he was a member of the core alliance who had the biggest personality?
Yeah, I definitely think that Paul might have functioned more as the mouthpiece of the alliance rather than the leader, because even in his preseason interviews, he was saying he was going to be a big bombastic figure, not necessarily a hugely strategic guy. And I think that was probably a good part on Brett and Chris at the time to bring him in to function as sort of that aforementioned meat shield. But I guess sort of the downside to that from Paul's standpoint in the game is that he's going to stick out his neck way in front much more than the other guys. That's going to allow everyone else to kind of roll through and chop his head off with a giant riding lawnmower.
Yeah, I mean, I think just none of them, well, not I think, I know, just judging from the looks on their faces, that none of them expected it to happen so soon. You know, I suspect Chris and Brett fully intended for him to, you know, take the slings and arrows, but not for a while.
And that segues nicely into rule two: don't scheme and plot too much. Now, we just kind of touched upon this, but due to his role in the alliance, did you believe that Paul could have possibly been a little overbearing with his scheming and plotting? Or do you think it was more of a character thing than a strategy thing?
Well, it's not really that he was scheming too much, but he did violate this rule in a couple of different ways. You know, the rule has a variety of different aspects to it, and one of them is that you have to keep your scheming secret. He obviously didn't do a very good job of that, and this does come back to his statement or misstatement that if a guy's alliance came together, the ladies would be on their own. he apparently didn't mean it to come out that way, but it did. And so we look at what happened there and compare it to something that Rob said, because during this podcast last week, I argued with Rob about something he had said on Know It Alls. And now that he's not here, I can praise him without, you know, him getting too big ahead.
Praise away.
Yeah. So on Know It Alls, he made a comparison between what Paul said and what happened with Rob and Alex in the Amazon when Alex told Rob that he'd vote Rob out later. And both Rob at the time and everyone watching on TV, we were all like, what did he just say? Because I'm pretty sure that's what everyone was thinking, or in some cases saying out loud or tweeting, when we saw Paul tell Jessica that he was going to tell the ladies they were on their own. And on top of that, it happened in a really strange way. Taron Armstrong summarized it pretty well when he took a break from watching Big Brother Over the Top to tweet about Survivor. And he said, "That was super weird. Paul's tone was a reassuring one, but his words were the opposite." And I was thinking the same thing. It felt like he thought he was saying completely different words. And in his interview since then, he says, I don't remember saying that. I don't remember saying it that way. So I'm not really sure what happened between his brain and his mouth. But what came out was not keeping his scheming secret. Mm-hmm. Indeed, in his CBS post-show interview, which some people listening will remember I used to quote from the 8 things that, you know, the person who played wants you to know, or the 10 things or the 12 things. I haven't seen those anymore. Now CBS has a full on interview, so I think that has taken the place. But anyway, in that interview, he said his biggest mistake was that he meant to tell Jessica they were all staying together, but it came out as he would go with the guys no matter what. Yeah, saying the opposite of what you meant is kind of a big mistake. You know,
unless it was opposite day on the island. You never know what these crazy Gen Xers may do.
Hey. Oh, that's right. You know, I'm used to talking to a fellow Gen Xer. Now I'm dealing with a millennial here.
Yeah, you're dealing with me, and I'm using you as just the letter and not even spelling it out phonetically.
Man. Well, we'll plow through, I guess. But, you know, in that interview, he claimed that he had talked to Jessica in private and that she knew better, but she used it against him. I'm not convinced. I don't think she really did know better. I think she was as confused as all of us were in watching it. Mm-hmm. I think she believed that he slipped up and accidentally revealed his actual intent. In one of his exit interviews, Paul said, you know, again, continuing when he was talking about Jessica, that she was paranoid about everything that happened, so he should have watched his words more carefully. He said he thought he was conveying that the 6 of them would stay together, just like he said in that other interview. I just don't know how he thought that at the time. But at least in his interviews, he took the blame and he said it was his own fault for not being more careful with his words.
Yeah, I would say that this is one of those key moments in Survivor where there's a clear difference between tone and content. And I think this has been talked about on the podcast. I think actually Rob and Aris might have had this conversation in their fantastic recap this week, where there are 2 ways you could take that conversation, right? You could take Paul's words to mean what a lot of us took and Jessica herself took at face value, which was him saying, great, when it gets to us 6 down the line, I'm going to go with the guys and basically say you're on your own. Or it was him trying to take that aforementioned reassuring tone and saying, you know, if the guys are targeting you, I will let you guys know. It seems like he was trying to indicate the latter, but it came off like the former. But Survivor is a game where perception is always reality. And if you don't realize what the perception is, that's going to lead to your reality come crashing down around you.
Right. And I think if he hadn't used the phrase, ladies, you're on your own, he might have been okay. I just don't know how he thought those words could be interpreted as any way other than ladies, you're on your own.
Yeah.
There was another part of this rule where Paul made a mistake. We didn't really see it on TV, but I do have something to add from web confessional information. It looks like he may have over-schemed a bit as well, because in Sunday's confessional, she said that she and Jessica seemingly caught Paul in a contradiction because he told each of them that he wanted to go to the end with them.
Oof.
Now, if we acknowledge that Paul sometimes didn't do a great job of saying what he meant, we could charitably say that Paul didn't literally mean final two when he said the end, but maybe he was indicating he wanted to go to the end with both of them.
Maybe he went, I'll go to the end with you. And by that, I mean the end of your games when I vote you out in sixth, fifth, and fourth.
Right. When I say, ladies, you're on your own. You know, however he said it, again, made the ladies think that he was not really with them. And because of that, it did, in fact, look like plotting and scheming too much.
All right, David, rule number three is be flexible. How flexible was Paul for a 52-year-old man?
Well, considering the interactions we saw between him and some of the other players, I would say that flexibility was not his strong suit.
Well, was he as flexible as Sunday's kids are, apparently?
Yeah. I saw Sunday tweeting about having heard that podcast. She at least found it amusing. So,
all right, that's good. We got, you know, 19 out of 20 are still on RHAP's side far. We lost one, but that was a casualty.
And that happened before the season even started.
Exactly.
Paul seemed to be used to being able to tell people what to do and just have them listen. He even said in a secret scene confessional back from the second episode that he has to be in control all the time. He has no choice in the matter. Now, this somewhat conflicts with the statement he made to Josh that I had mentioned earlier about how he never felt like he was the leader of the Alliance. But whether he was leading the Alliance or not, or he was just bossing people around camp, he was definitely violating the part of this rule that says you need to be especially flexible in dealing with people in the early game. And, you know, he didn't even make it past the early game.
Yes, exactly. He didn't make it past the part where you need to probably be the most flexible. And this is probably one of the reasons why a lot of people picked Paul to go out early, is because even he admitted to it. Granted, it's great to sort of be able to look at yourself and know your faults. But when you're not able to develop those faults into a decent survivor game, then there's still faults at that.
Right.
All right, David, rule number four is don't let your emotions control you. Now, obviously, Paul had quite an emotional week last week, considering his heat stroke and near heart attack. Did those emotions carry over into this week and possibly lead to his demise?
I don't think so. This rule mostly deals with how you act and letting those emotions affect you in terms of who you're going to vote out or, you know, dealing with them. And, you know, his plan was to stick with the core alliance, no matter what he may have said. And it made rational sense for that group to vote out Cece, which was his plan, and nothing affected that. So I think he did okay in this role.
I'd say so as well. It didn't seem like any sort of scenes we were seeing was he having any breakdown, again, aside from the physical one. And even then, I feel like even the strongest players, I mean, we've seen Boston Rob have a case of crybabyitis and go down on his own and have his own, let his emotions control him for a second. But at least the narrative this episode seemed to dictate that emotions were not Paul's problem. In fact, maybe Paul's lack of emotions and tact with treating some members of his alliance might have led to his demise.
Right. And actually, that leads nicely into the fifth rule.
Absolutely. So the fifth rule is pretend to be nice / play the social game. How good was Paul's social game, David?
It almost sounds like you know the answer to this already.
Absolutely. It's a rhetorical question, but let's answer it regardless.
You know, obviously, he did have a bit of an issue pretending to be nice and playing the social game. We saw some of this, of course, but I feel like that might have been only the tip of the iceberg. And I say this because there were other people that talked about it. So in Jeff Probst's Entertainment Weekly interview, he said Paul was his own worst enemy. He didn't know how his behavior impacted others. And he had no idea that he was coming across as bossy. In Sunday's web confessional that I mentioned earlier, she said she felt like Paul thought he was running the game. In Lucy's web confessional, showing that she actually is in the game, she said that she had wanted to get rid of Paul in the very first vote. And in Paul's own CBS interview, he said if he could go back, he'd like to think he would have been a little tamer and less bossy, but he probably would actually have done the same thing. He said, quote, "That's the only way I know how to be. You can only fake it for so long, and then your personality's going to come out." It's basically what you just said. It's one thing to recognize the problem, but it's another to change it. And he's flat out saying, yeah, I could go back there, but I'd be the same way. His personality did come out, and it wasn't something that worked in his favor.
Well, let's segue that a little bit into his talk with the millennials at the summit. And it seemed like, again, according to the edit, he was holding court for a while, even though he did kind of disparage some of the millennials with this talk about music. I know that was a sticking point for Haley Strong in particular. Do you think he utilized some of his social skills with the other tribe, at least in this episode?
I think he did, but it didn't matter because he didn't make it that far. I think from some of the other confessionals that we saw on the web, you know, the younger people gravitated towards him. I think they saw him as, you know, kind of being the cool old guy, you know, the long hair, the, you know, does whatever he wants. And that's great if you're not living with him all the time, if he's not trying to direct you in building a shelter or starting a fire or whatever else. If you're just hanging out for a couple hours and splashing around in the water, yeah, that's fine. But that's not who he needed to play nice with.
I'd be intrigued to hear from you, David. Do you think there's such thing as a pre-game social game? And I'm only asking because I remember in the pre-game for this show, a lot of people were saying, oh yeah, you know, I'm obviously not allowed to talk to people, but I recognize Rockstar Santa, the guy who looks like Van Halen. Clearly, Paul was one of the people to pick out. Do you think there is a benefit or a cost to sticking out so much in the very beginning of the game, even before people are talking?
I think it can be both. I think you have to project, you know, friendliness, a charm as much as you can. You can't, for example, always have a look on your face like Lucy's profile picture from the website. And I know that's not her fault, you know, but
as Lucy would say, she shushed you right there with your talk about her press picture.
He did stand out and he looked like a fun guy. And so I'm sure that helped. And that was one of the reasons that the millennials gravitated towards him. But again, it's what you look like there is not necessarily what you're going to act like at camp. You can try to make as much contact as possible just by, giving looks, using body language and the like. And I would certainly encourage all players to try it. But if you contradict that when you actually start living with them, it's not going to matter much.
So you're encouraging future Survivor contestants to take a page out of Jeff Varner's book and start to study the players for any crotch framing that may happen.
Yeah.
The key is in the crotch. I mean, Spencer Bledsoe did finish as runner up on Survivor 31. So I guess the proof is in the pudding there.
If he had framed just a little bit better, he probably would have won.
Well, I don't know. There were a lot of older people on the jury, so they might not have respected what Spencer was doing with his crotch there in the final tribal council. Just a hunch. David, rule number 6, don't be too much of a threat. Now, Paul might have accidentally threatened the women in his comments that we've talked about before, but was Paul himself a threat?
Well, this is where we have the main debate when it comes to Paul, and I had hinted at it earlier because, like I said, a number of people have said Jessica's comment about the women being on the bottom, it didn't make sense because there were three of them and three men in the alliance. But the key there is the assumption that the women were only concerned about those three guys, and I don't think that's the case. It seemed to me that Jessica and the others were concerned about a larger group of guys taking control of the tribe after voting out two women if Cece had gone. We know from Paul's interviews that Paul, Chris, and Brett had repeatedly approached Ken and tried to get him into that alliance. We know from what we saw that David tried kissing up to the guys too. I trust you, until I get to the summit and then I'm going to turn on you. But, you know, they didn't know about that part. So I think it's perfectly reasonable for the women to worry about this. I think it happens all the time whenever, you know, if two men are voted out in a row, then the men start to say, oh, there's a women's alliance. If a couple of women are voted out in a row, then the women start to worry also. And that's the way it looked like it was going to happen. It's easy for us to sit here and say they made a big move too soon just for the sake of making a move. But I don't think that's the case. I think they were legitimately looking ahead and worrying about what might happen. In further support of this, I will also point to Will's web confessional, in which he said it seemed to him from the summit that all the men except David were in control of the tribe. Now, how did he get that information? Well, probably out of the mouths and actions of some of the Gen X summit ambassadors.
Oh, no, no. I mean, probably the mouths and the actions of two of them in particular. I mean, I feel like we haven't found out too much about what Chris's game is, but you could bet if David and Paul are on a journey together, they're both going to probably be flapping at the guns the entire time.
Yeah. So I think that this impression was there. Whether it was real or not, it's unclear. But if that impression was there, it made Paul an apparent threat to Jessica, Lucy, and Sunday, as they saw it. He was the standard bearer for the guys, the apparent leader, the guy who was being bossy to them. And, of course, he was the guy who apparently told them they were on their own if the guys banded together. That made him the biggest threat going forward in their eyes.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that threat is a very big umbrella term. And I think the first thing that you go to when you think threat is threat to win. And I wouldn't necessarily assign Paul to that, but I would almost say threat to be a power player in that, as you just mentioned, should this alliance happen to make it to the top six, it seems like from Paul's words, and maybe not his intentions, but his words, that he would be the one that would spearhead the subsequent taking out of them and the bringing of the guys to the end. So while that may not be, oh, Paul might rob us of $1 million, it will be Paul might be responsible for taking us out. And from that perspective, I could see the argument for him being a threat.
Right. And I wouldn't even say it has to wait that long. I think Josh and Rob were talking in the Wiggle Room about how the producers might keep the tribes as, you know, millennials and Gen X for a while, just to keep that battle going. And if the women were thinking that as well, well, okay, if they vote out Cece and the men really are all together, who's next? Well, Jessica, Lucy, or Sunday. So even though there was this claim of a core six-person alliance, you know, there's what people are saying, and then there's what the women are seeing. And what they're seeing is the women being targeted.
Do you think that might be then just a more conservative view of the game from the Gen Xers' perspective? Because I feel like there are enough Survivor fans on that season that they might be thinking, oh yeah, a switch is coming any day now, and it might kind of go against what Josh and Rob were talking about on this week's Wiggle Room. But if that's the case, and I think one of the reasons why people are taking fault with Jessica and the women's decision is that they feel like, if you are a fan of Survivor, you'll know there'll be a twist eventually that may either benefit you or hurt you. Therefore, why are you deciding to do this right here, right now? But it seems like from what you're implying is that they're not really thinking about that. They're more so thinking about the worst case scenario. If we stay on this tribe, we need to make sure that we're well insulated.
Right. And even if it's two episodes away, say, that still could be one or two votes. And if they think the women are being picked off, do they want to roll the dice and take that chance? Or do they just want to switch things up and move to the top? And as you said, insulate themselves.
Final rule, David, vote out the weak, then the strong, then the weak, then the strong. Now, this was the second time that Gen X went to tribal council this season. The first time they voted off a definitively weak person. I can say that because she's the one of the 20 that is probably sworn off RHAP so far. Has Gen X ascribed to this rule? Would you consider Paul strong?
Well, instead of answering that question, let me act like a presidential candidate and pivot a little here.
to all those undecided podcast listeners in the
that's
corner.
That's right. The tribe, as you said, is only in their second vote. So really, they should be still in the phase of getting rid of the weak. Now, one thing to remember is that the term weak has two possible meanings. Either those who will hurt you in challenges, so that's kind of the obvious one, or those who hurt the overall tribe dynamic. The question is whether Paul falls into either of these, or we have another situation like last week when people within the tribe did the opposite of what they apparently should have. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk about how terrible Cece was in the challenge, and I'm certainly not going to argue against that. But I found some interesting things in the online confessionals. Turns out there was a wide gulf in the opinions about who did worse. So you had the guys like Brett and Chris talking about how bad CeCe was. But Ken and David specifically mentioned how slow Paul was. Obviously, it might not be a coincidence that opinions lined up right along alliance lines, but it also tells me that it may not be so cut and dried that CeCe was the worst of all of them. Or even if she was the worst, Paul was no superstar. On top of that, Paul was clearly weak in terms of hurting the overall tribe dynamic. We've already spent a fair amount of time going over that, so I don't think we need to repeat it now. But that certainly could have played into the situation in wanting a tribe that was perhaps a little calmer, especially for the women. So did they vote out the physically weakest person? Probably not. But did they vote out a weak link? Yeah, I think they did.
Yeah, I could definitely see that, especially as you mentioned, if there is more disparate remarks from other members of the tribe about how Paul was not great in the challenge. I think in the first couple challenges, he seemed to be at least holding his all, though he might have been a reason why the Gen Xers took both shortcuts the first time around, since he couldn't really fit through that apparatus. But he definitely was not, I would say, one of the giant workhorses of the tribe, which might again have been another reason why the women were fine to lose him rather than maybe someone like Brett or Chris, who, while they may be spurned, are definitely two of the stronger guys on the tribe. So I guess if we're going with the various definitions of weak, Paul kind of checks all the boxes there.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not the situation that we had last week with Mari, where we just had to throw up our hands
and grab a controller.
That's right. Yeah. Put another quarter in. That's exactly. The Gen X thing. You wouldn't get that. I know.
Hey, you know what? I played enough Simpsons Arcade in my various friends' birthday parties when I was a kid to know about it at least a little bit.
Oh, okay. Okay.
David, any more thoughts about Paul and his downfall, if you will?
Well, we do have at least one appendix that I should mention here, and that's Appendix A talks about idol hunting. Do everything you can to get an idol. Now, Paul didn't seem like the type of guy to go out idol hunting, and he now says he was pretty sure David already had one, and that's true. David does already have one. But even if Paul had an idol in his pocket, he had zero reason to believe he needed it. He wouldn't have played it, even if a painted coconut had fallen out of a tree and conked him on his head. So really nothing more to discuss there. And Appendix B talks about the jury, so we can skip right on past that one.
Yeah, Paul ain't seeing the jury anytime soon unless he gets a letter in the mail about it.
So Paul was the first person voted out of what seemed to be a solid majority alliance. And I think that pushed many people to say Jessica, Sunday, and Lucy were too eager to make a big move and flip the game, as I had mentioned. It seemed like they were looking too far ahead and should have just let things play out as the guys had planned. But as I mentioned, I'm not convinced that's a criticism that can be fairly leveled based on the information the ladies had available to them at the time. When the men in the tribe vote out a woman first, and then they plan to vote out another, like I said, they have to wonder if something is up. When the apparent leader of their own alliance says the ladies are on their own if the guys decide to all get together, they have to wonder some more. When that same guy has made seemingly contradictory schemes with different women, that continues to add to the question of sneakiness. And when that same person is bossy and annoying, causes some strife, and is not exactly a superstar in the challenges, the straws on that camel's back are really starting to add up.
Yeah, and that camel has a heart attack.
Yeah.
And then Dr. Joe's a great veterinarian as well, from what I hear.
I did not know that. Yeah, Paul told Josh in the pregame interview that he was either going to be the first one voted out or he was going to win. And usually when someone says that, they're one of the first ones voted out because they're playing too hard. From the perspective of the information the ladies had available, indeed, that was the situation. They were not the ones playing too hard. Paul was. Instead of being on the bottom in a minority after the second vote, the women got together and, as Sunday noted in a web confessional, flipped things around so the four moms are on the top of the tribe. Now, you know, we've heard a lot about women's alliances, but this may be the first mom alliance.
Aside from Susie and Crystal from Survivor Gabon.
Yeah, but, you know, four of them. I think four creates a whole alliance, don't
you? That's, yeah, Fong only had three, I think. So so they've topped it at this point.
Now, Paul either said things he didn't mean, or he accidentally said what he did mean and revealed secret plans. Either way, it wasn't good. On top of it, he was bossy, he didn't have a good social game, he caused division and weakness in the tribe. Time will tell if the women made the right move, but whether they did what was the correct thing for them or not, these reasons explain why Paul lost.
That's a great summary. And yes, I think a lot of people may see that it was maybe too rash of a decision. But when you're talking about the post-merge, everyone says that there are pivotal numbers like 9, 7, sometimes 5, where you need to have that configuration, so a specific configuration. If you wait too long, you're going to get bit in the ass and not with the Jeff Varner variety. And you can almost take this tribe as like a smaller microcosm of a post-merge 9, where I think that Sunday, Jessica and Lucy felt they had gotten scared by Paul's actions, and they thought that this was the time. They needed to do this now, because as you mentioned before, if CC went home, then they're outnumbered. They could try to make a move with Ken and David, but by then the guys might have roped them in. They knew they could have the numbers right now, so why not make the move? On top of it, they're getting rid of somebody who wasn't that big of a physical presence. He was more of a mouthpiece than he was a bicep of the tribe. So I think you did a great job of summarizing why, even though it was a little shocking at first, admittedly, when I watched the episode the first time, I thought, oh, they're totally editing Paul to become like the decoy edit. And to have that come to fruition was a little shocking, but I think you did a great job of explaining in hindsight why they did what they did.
Well, thank you.
All right. Now, do we want to talk a little bit about what this coming week's episode may provide us?
Yeah. You know, I'll go ahead and start and you can chime in. At this point, it seems like just about everything is up in the air on both tribes, just from watching the show, the web confessionals, everything. And, you know, rather than trying to guess which tribe will lose immunity, I think we should look at both in case either of them end up at tribal council.
Good contingency plan. Absolutely. Very Gen X of you to to not throw caution into the wind there.
I learn from my mistakes, you know, or I try anyway.
Yeah, we're not going to the metaphoric prediction North Dakota anytime soon.
Yeah.
So I just talked about North Dakota as like the representation of danger in the United States.
All right. I have to admit you lost me on that one. So must be one of those millennial jokes.
Yep, absolutely.
On the Gen X tribe, I still feel Cece isn't in a great place. I mean, yeah, Jessica, Sunday, and Lucy saved her. But for how long? Once they have what appears to be a majority along with Ken and David, I guess the question comes up, do they really need to keep the person who has clearly been the weakest in challenges? Mm-hmm. I can't imagine if they lose that they get rid of Chris or Brett instead, because then they're just setting themselves up to keep losing.
Yeah.
And
an Australian Survivor definitely indicated, not to spoil too much, but if you're down in the numbers, maybe it's not the best idea to keep getting rid of people that might hold their own in the challenges.
Right. Especially since you don't know how long you're going to be with this group. I mean, if they knew for a fact, oh, a swap is coming next week, sure, then get rid of Chris or Brett because he might end up on the opposite tribe. But you don't know. And that's what's great is they keep them guessing. So I think it could come back to Cece, even though they have that mom alliance. They might just have to take a solid look at Cece and go, yeah, she's just not doing it for us if they lose again.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that Brett and Chris, even though like Zeke and Adam, they got blindsided in this past couple of episodes, I think they're in a much better position because, like you said, they're pretty invaluable to the tribe in physicality. And I know that next episode seems like at least one challenge is going to be our basket brawl, our all on one, all, you know, tops are flying off battle in the water. When that's where these guys are going to come in handy. And maybe someone like Cece, who might be a little bit slow, lower moving in the water, might become more of a liability than them.
Right. And there's another issue, too, because although they have the mom alliance, I still don't feel like she's an integral member. You know, during the show, Cece complained that no one was coming up to her for strategy discussion. And as everyone should know by now, if people aren't approaching you, it generally means you're in big trouble. She managed to escape the trouble this week. I'm just not convinced it will be extended another week. And I know we saw the clip of Lucy suddenly coming out of her shell and being a dictator, but I just find it hard to believe her behavior would suddenly be so bad that it would cause the tribe to completely turn on her. I mean, yeah, stranger things have happened in this game, but I'm still going to stick with my prediction of Cece.
All right.
If Gen X returns to Tribal Council.
And I know that Rob sent us a message beforehand in absentia that he believes he's buying into the next time on that Lucy comes out of her purple shell, her purple coconut husk, if you will, only to get chopped, and that the dictator will fall. So I guess we'll see if that comes to fruition. I personally am probably more slighted towards you. I think that maybe this Lucy thing might be a decoy. I definitely think that Brett and Chris are pretty safe for now, again, because of the value they hold to the tribe. I would say it would be between Cece and Lucy, in my opinion, and I'm going to have to say Cece later, because if she's being used as a number in the last tribal council, I think there's a very good chance that this new power alliance decides that her number is up and decides to promptly throw her away as a result.
Yeah, yeah. So if the millennial tribe goes to tribal council, well, here we have a whole bunch of hinkiness going on. You know, Michelle may have saved Figgy earlier, but now she has said in a web confessional that she doesn't want to work with Figgy. She wants to work with Adam. We saw Adam trying to explain the math of the situation to Michaela on the show. I'm not sure if she was buying off on it or not. And then we have Zeke, who's also on the bottom, saying in his own web confessional that he thinks Jay may be his best ticket, not Adam, Hannah, or even Will. So we have at least a couple people wanting to abandon their allies in favor of new situations. Now, Zeke, of course, has obvious reasons for wanting to change things up, and Michelle may also have good reasons if she doesn't trust Figgy. But how's it all going to shake out? Honestly, beats me. I don't know. But if I had to guess, which, you know, that's what I have to do here, I'd say that Zeke and Adam will be safe. And I think that Figgy being saved once was about all most people could stomach. So I'm going to say if the millennials go back to tribal council, the showmance will be over and Figgy's torch will be snuffed. So really, it's similar to the Gen X tribe in that each of them has someone who was saved once. And I think that the person who was saved is not going to make it past the next tribal council.
Well, I guess that's going to be a harbinger of doom, because apparently if you write Figgy's name down, you go home. So I guess everyone who voted against Figgy is going to get subsequently eliminated as a result.
Well, most of them will anyway.
Yeah, I guess that's the point of the show. I mean, I agree that Zeke and Adam will be safe. I'm going to make a bold prediction and say that I feel like Adam is going to find the idol. Maybe this episode, maybe next episode, but there's something about, you know, him walking by that clam. Maybe, you know, I don't think he's brought up his mother yet on Survivor, but I feel like that'd be a perfect time to tie in the story of his mother to his idol hunt. I feel like it's going to happen, especially since he's on the outs. I feel like if the millennials are going to tribal council, I feel like Zeke and Adam are going to get revenge on Hannah. And I feel like there's a good chance that Hannah could be the one to go home, because she does have close connections to someone like Michelle, as the episode one secret scene and, you know, the behavior in episode two tribal council showed. But if there are people gunning for her, and as you might have surmised, if the freaks and geeks might try to semi-form themselves back together to go against the Triforce and friends of the Triforce, I feel like Hannah might be someone who gets bit in the butt after what she did a couple of episodes ago.
I don't know. I can't imagine they'll turn on Hannah. Wouldn't you think that they would turn on either the showmance or the person who convinced Hannah?
Yeah, I can definitely see, and I think it makes more sense, but I don't know, something's just telling me, maybe it's the edit that Michelle's gotten, but I feel like it would be a weird story if she was such a pivotal role in episode two, only to go the next tribal council. Survivor's done weirder things with editing, but for some reason, maybe it was because of the thing we talked about at the very beginning of this podcast, where Zeke and Adam were obviously very miffed with Hannah. I could totally see a storyline where they decide to get their vengeance sooner rather than later and take her out, especially if there happens to be an instance where she doesn't do too well in the challenge, and then they have an excuse.
Yeah, it could happen.
All right, so our predictions are set in stone. Rob did not give a prediction for millennials, so it seems like his choice of Gen X going to tribal council is set in stone. Any other predictions you'd like to make, David?
I predict that Rob will be back next week.
Oh, all right. We'll see if that happens.
Wearing mouse ears.
Yeah, we'll see. Hopefully no accidents happen in the Magic Kingdom that would not allow our fearless leader to return to the podcast, because he has a lot of podcasts down the line Survivor related, as we've talked about. If you haven't listened to this week's slew of podcasting yet, we've had a recap with Aris Bashkauskas, voicemails with Haley Strong, The Wiggle Room as always. This week on Survivor Recaps, we've obviously got Survivor Know-It-Alls on Wednesday night. Randy Bailey is doing the recap with voicemails with Miles Nye. Two great guys, I'm going to assume, make a prediction. Two great podcasts as well, hopefully about a great episode of Survivor. And this itself has been a great podcast, David. Thank you so much for allowing me on to pinch hit for Rob on the Why Blank Lost. You can follow David at David Bloomberg. I am at a Mike Bloom type. David, to finish things off, do we have a hashtag for people who made it all the way to the end of this podcast?
How does Mom Alliance sound?
Mom Alliance. So is it all one word, or actually, I guess it's all one word because it's a hashtag that shows my millennialness. Mom Alliance. Let's make it a thing. Mom Alliance. It's like that movie Bad Moms that just came out. I don't know why I'm comparing it to that, but that's all I'm reminded of. They're not girls. They're moms, to quote a wise woman from Survivor, Sam Wandoser. David, thank you so much again for having me on. This is the first podcast you and I have done together, and it probably is only going to confuse more of the people that confuse us based on our last names.
Yeah. You know, we've been talking about the Bloom and Bloomberg podcast, so, you know, everything finally came together.
Exactly. It's our names are nested within each other, like an immunity idol is nested within a coconut. All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. Rob will be back on Wednesday night to begin the Survivor Week anew. For now, hashtag Mom Alliance.